So first of all, this is Nivi from Venture Hacks, and I'm talking to Eric Ries from, where are you from?
From the Lessons Learned blog.
From the Lessons Learned blog, formerly from ImView, formerly an advisor to Kleiner Perkins. We're just going to have a discussion on a few topics of Eric's and mine choosing. First topic, what is the minimum viable product? Talk to me about minimum viable products.
Okay, well, let's start with the question of why do we build products in the first place?
Okay.
So in the end, we hope to be able to launch a product to lots of customers and have them give us money so that we build a great business. One approach to solving that problem would be let's build a product with the maximum number of features that will maximize our chance of success in the end. But the problem with that is you don't get any feedback until you've already built all those different products,
Yeah.
all those different features. And so you ship this product with a ton of features. And generally, by the time it's done, it's too late to make sure that you are on the right track.
Yeah.
So an alternative would be let's do the release early, release often thing, and let's get feedback as we go. The issue there is if you just follow the release early, release often mantra, you find yourself kind of running around in circles. Because you ship code, you get some feedback from people, you do a focus group, some customers say, give me feature X, give me feature Y. Now you're kind of like, maybe sometimes you do what they want, maybe sometimes you're going to do what you want, and then they get mad at you, and you're kind of chasing your own tail a little bit because you're not operating against a clear long-term vision of what you're trying to accomplish.
Okay.
So the idea of minimum viable product is useful because you can basically say, look, our vision is to build a product that solves this core problem for customers, and
it's
kind of these kind of general feature areas. And we think that for the people who are kind of the early adopters for that kind of solution, they will be the most forgiving, and they will kind of fill in their minds the kind of features that aren't quite there if we give them the kind of core kind of tentpole features that point the direction of where we're trying to go.
Yeah.
So the minimum viable product is that product which has just those features and no more, that allows you to ship a product that early adopters see, and at least some of whom resonate with, pay you money for, and start to give you feedback on.
So there's some set of customers out there, we believe, that just with these features alone, this product is useful to them.
Exactly right. And sometimes it's useful to them because because early adopters have the same kind of visioning power that entrepreneurs do.
Yeah.
That is because they can see what the end product is going to be.
Right.
There are cases where you ship them a product that actually doesn't work very well.
Yep.
InView, first version of that product, worked pretty terribly. But, for example, it was all about user-generated content. And we wanted to get developers on the platform. And the problem with developer platforms is you have this chicken and egg problem. Developers don't want to develop unless there's customers who are there to buy their products. And customers don't want to come on the platform unless developers are there selling them something useful. What we did is we took early adopter developers and we told them a story about how InView was going to take over the world and be this really powerful product for mainstream customers. And we made them believe it. And we gave them an economic incentive that said, the earlier you get on board with the platform, the more kind of the bigger that your take is going to be for derivative products that get created down the road. So we shipped a product that basically had almost no customers, certainly no mainstream customers, and the developer tools weren't that great.
Right.
But because we had told that story effectively and we really understood those early adopter developers, we got a ton of them on the platform developing because they felt like they were in the middle of a gold rush.
Okay.
Despite the fact that there was really no evidence to support that belief other than their own power of imagining what this thing was going to be, down the road. Luckily, we delivered on that vision, and so they actually all, wound up pretty happy.
How about some examples of crazy minimum viable products? So by which I mean, for example, and you can talk about any of these, the AdWords approach, the approach you talked about in terms of dialog boxes, and just popping those up, just trying to sell a PowerPoint slide to an enterprise customer.
Well, let me start with an example of a time we didn't build a minimum viable product
Okay.
to illustrate my point. It was 2004. You got to remember 2004, Bush versus Kerry election. At InView, we had this idea. It happens to entrepreneurs all the time, where you wake up in the shower and you're like, I got an idea for a killer product.
Right.
The idea for us, this was probably September, October 2004. Debates are happening. Politics is in the air. Our idea is we're going to sell a presidential debate avatar set.
Okay.
You'll be able to dress up like Kerry or Bush, and you'll be able to debate with your friends, in this kind of 3D presidential debate product. Now, put aside for a second whether that actually seems like a good idea to anybody else.
Yeah.
We convinced ourselves it was a great idea.
Right.
And we spent 2 full weeks racing to get this thing built.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it was time sensitive. The election's coming. The debates are happening. Every day counts. And we thought it was a great idea for that whole 2 weeks. We built it out and we shipped it. We spent just countless hours debating exactly what features had to be in it or not in it. And we were going to sell it for $1.99. The theory was pricing won't get in the way of anybody buying this thing. We want to make it cheap and easy. And we're going to get lots of buzz. And, you know, Wall Street Journal and New York Times are going to cover this thing. It's going to be awesome.
Right.
And remember, for us in those days, 2 weeks of development time was a lot because we were a pretty fast team. So we did that. We shipped it. I'm cutting to the chase. Nobody bought it.
Right.
We sold exactly 0 copies of the Kerry V. Bush avatar. And we tried a bunch of different permutations and different variations of it and added features, and we changed the price, and we eventually gave it away for free. And even at free,
we couldn't sell any copies. Well, how many people bought it for
free? None. We literally couldn't give this thing away. This thing was a dead weight money loser. There's actually, no, as far as we can tell, nobody in America interested in like having a presidential debate avatar.
So how would you have taken this, like how would you have approached this exact same product but taken the minimum viable product approach?
Well, it was interesting. We thought we were taking the minimum viable product approach because we'd only spent 2 weeks on it, right?
Okay.
And somewhere we had like made a very early prototype and put it out there.
Yeah.
But if you think about it, going back to the definition of a minimum viable product, which is the minimum feature set required to learn what customers want, we had spent way too much time on it. What we should have done, and what we did for a lot of other features thereafter, is started with the landing page just that promised people that product. And then we should have taken out the AdWords we were planning to take out, drive traffic to that landing page, and offer people to buy the experience that we're talking about. What we would have found out if we'd done that experiment is 0% of people would have clicked through, which means it doesn't matter what's on the second page. The first page is so bad, not because it's badly designed, but because the features are wrong,
right,
that you don't need to go through the effort of building out this whole product. So we wish we had done that, and we didn't make that mistake.
Right? How would you have marketed that minimum viable product to your existing customers?
So when you already have customers, you need to have some way to experiment with making them an offer.
Yeah.
And in a lot of cases, the minimum viable product really is just that offer. If you can crisply articulate to customers what they're going to get and how much they're going to pay for it, you can learn a lot by just popping up a dialog box that says, hey, would you like this new feature? Or showing them a banner ad for that feature. So like, for example, in InView, we had a system set up so that we could arbitrarily from the server select a small percentage of customers and make them an offer like that by inserting a dialog box into their conversation. And like, basically it's a simple yes, no. Would you like this thing? Yes or no? When they say yes, we take them to a landing page where we try to sell it to them. And eventually, if they really did want it, we'd eventually have to make up some excuse why we couldn't give it to them. Like, oh, we're experiencing technical difficulties right now.
Yeah.
We haven't quite, not quite ready to give it to you. Give us your email address. We'll email you when it's ready.
Right.
But again, got to remember that 99% of the time, nobody wants it. Most offers that appear to entrepreneurs a good idea are actually horrible, horrible ideas. And so, you know, by making the offer and having it be rejected by customers, you learn like not to waste time building stuff that nobody wants.
Right. So maybe the right definition of a minimum viable product, like you were saying, is essentially a test to see whether people actually want the product that you're imagining in your head.
That's right. And the reason why this is an art, not a science, is I'll have entrepreneurs come up to me and say, well, but hold on, my customers don't know what they want. So if I ask them, do you want this thing, they might say no when the answer is really yes.
Yes.
And unfortunately, that's an excuse that's used way too often. But there are situations where it's true. So the judgment call is, what really is the minimum set? You know, in some cases, like in entertainment products, it might actually require you to build an early prototype or a mock-up or even, you know, version one of the product with the minimum possible set of features that you think can go. But the nice thing about minimum feature set is you can always try intermediate points to ask yourself, am I at the minimum feature set yet? Am I at the minimum feature set yet? As long as you're not afraid of the false negative, that is, if you don't get discouraged because you built your first kind of paper prototype of it, showed it to people, nobody wanted it.
Yeah.
That can't mean that, like, you give up because, forget it, we'll never make it. You got to say, okay, well, then let's iterate some more. If you keep iterating at it, keep making it a little bit more sophisticated, at a certain point, after you've been through 10 iterations and you still got no uptake whatsoever, and the feedback you're getting from customers is still a yawn, you might say to yourself, you know what? We're not moving in the right direction.
Yeah.
In fact, we're past the point of minimum viable product. This just isn't a viable product.
Right. And I mean, back to your point about entertainment, you know, in Hollywood, they start off with a script.
Yeah.
If that's okay, if the script looks good, then they will make a pilot. mm-hmm. if the pilot looks good, then they might order a few episodes from the first season, right? Half of the first season, then they may extend it from there.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't build all three seasons and then try to ship them.
Yeah, which means that some great shows never get made.
Right.
Because the early tests look negative and the people involved don't have the courage or stamina to see it all the way through.
Right.
But on the other hand, sometimes people have the courage and stamina to see through a really bad idea.
Yeah.
So that's why the concept of learning is so important. You can't, this cannot be done on a spreadsheet. You have to keep training yourself on multiple iterations and multiple attempts to start to develop good instincts for, in your particular domain, your particular market space, what's likely to work and not work. And then you can do that as an entrepreneur, but even more powerful is if you can get your whole organization, everybody, training themselves constantly to do that kind of learning so that, you know, good ideas will be passed around the whole organization.
So, I mean, also, you know, minimum viable product ties into the concept of basically sell it before you build it, right? Are there any, like, other out-of-sequence things that you guys did at InView or elsewhere that you found helpful? Like, for example, I mean, you guys probably wrote tests before you coded to some degree as well.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, test-driven development's the same principle.
But I'm wondering if there's some other things that you guys have done.
Well, so people, if you think about the full range of the product development lifecycle, from specification to design to implementation to testing to maintenance to, you know, to sales to
deployment and all that stuff.
So, you know, I now think about that rather than as a linear sequence. I actually think about it as a big network. And the question is just for any given feature, in what path should you route it through that network?
Right.
And different features should be routed differently, just like on the internet, we route packets differently as, you know, necessary. So
I'm wondering if you have some specific examples of, like, paths you've taken.
Yeah, well, so we just talked about writing tests first. We've talked about selling first. We've talked about deploying first. Like
when did you deploy a product? When have you deployed something before you built it?
Yeah, well, all of these forms of offers of products.
Yeah.
Like, for example, in a lot of internet products, how does the customer know that the feature exists? Yes, there might be 100 pages of fancy, you know, stuff, but like, how do they even know that that stuff exists?
Okay.
Generally, it's because there's a link in the header. There's like one link on one key page that notifies them that they can go do this other thing.
Okay.
Or they, at a key moment, they receive an email. So even the feature might be wide and complicated. Generally, access to the feature is controlled through a simple choke point.
Mm-hmm.
We would often add those choke points in a split test just to see, you know, first of all, did anybody click on them? So like, we could look at the click-through rate of people like who now believe there's this feature. But we would also see an interesting phenomenon. Sometimes the presence of a feature, even if nobody clicks on it, still impacts their behavior in other ways. So, for example, we saw an experiment where, this isn't exactly right, but something to this effect. We added a link to the header notifying people that there was a VIP club for special people only to get access to on InView.
Okay.
Now, it's not the same as what we have now. InView does have a VIP club today that is not anything related to this.
Okay.
But in those days, the idea was we were trying to test whether people wanted to have some kind of premium experience. What happened was few people actually clicked on that link to go find out about the VIP club. But in the experimental cohort of people who were shown that header, their average spending was higher. So by constantly reminding them that there was such a thing as a premium experience, we primed them to want to do more spending on InView. It was a very unexpected result.
Yeah.
And it's a good example of why you always do full cohort-based split tests. Don't just, you know, always test for the macro effect. Don't look at the micro effect.
Okay.
So that's a case where deploying a feature before you've built it actually can give you an insight that, you know, maybe you don't need to build the feature after all.
Interesting. Yeah, so that reminds me of an example that one of our friends told us about. Where they couldn't get people to sign up for a free product.
Yeah.
So they put a paid version of the product right beside it. And I don't think anybody signed up for the paid version.
It made the free product look a lot more.
Yeah. it made the free product look legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
And their conversions, they started to actually convert on that basis.
Yeah. I mean, there's also cases where you want to design a product last rather than design it first. Like, we would often ship things in a schematic form with horrible design to see if we'd gotten the information flow and the information architecture right. And really good interaction designers, if they're being honest, will tell you that that's always the sequence. You always refactor your design out of specific use cases or out of specific uses rather than, like, starting with the, like, grand vision of what
so
it looks like.
Basically, the trails where the people walk, you pave those.
Exactly right. And you could do that, like... We had a, I remember one time, we used to use paper prototypes where you have designers sit down in a focus group with people and show them a piece, like a fake screenshot that they came up with in Photoshop. And then the customer says, I want to click that button. And you go grab the piece of paper that represents what happens when you click that button. You show them another prototype. And we used to do them that way. We actually built a paper prototyping website into our website where for certain customers, the designer could come in and actually replace sections of the website with full-on mock-ups from Photoshop that were sort of clickable and sort of functional.
Yeah.
And then we would bring a customer in, have them register an account. We'd specify that that account should see the paper prototype, and then we would go through with them, do the focus group. But the customer doesn't know that they're seeing something that's a mock-up. They think they're using the product. And yeah, the product's a little weird because sometimes they click things and nothing happens, or sometimes things don't look a little right, but customers think that about your product anyway.
Right.
So it's not like it's particularly abnormal for them to see a product that looks completely incoherent to them. That's the state of the art for most customers and most products. So that was another case where we would, and we would occasionally come up with some prototype like that functioned well enough that we would ship it to real customers.
Okay.
Rather than, you know, while we're working on the full-on blown, you know, beautiful version of it. And so some customers would see a schematic version from which we would gather more information about whether that kind of were on the right track and put things in the right place.
So what allowed you guys to, like, do all of this kind of experimentation? I guess specifically from a financial point of view, like not about like the mentality behind it and so on. Like,
yeah.
Time is short and money is running out. Or were you basically break even this whole time? Or how did you work that?
No. Well, we believed in a concept we called bridge to profitability.
Right.
Which is whenever we raise money, we always raise money on the basis of a plan that we honestly believe would get us to profitability on just that round. If you notice, that doesn't mean that we actually got to profitability on that round. In fact, we kept raising more rounds because we kept believing that we had the opportunity to pursue a bigger opportunity by raising money. But we never had to raise money. We always felt like we could get there on our own. But that meant we were constantly a dollar short, because plans to get to profitability on a round generally involve you going negative and then, you know, catching up before the money runs out.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were not eager to learn, eager to experiment. We did not love metrics.
Right.
We were very scrappy and very afraid of running out of money. And so we only ever adopted practices that we thought would have a high ROI. The issue is that these practices do have a high ROI, and we got to them because we kept following the traditional model and failing.
Okay.
And feeling like, God, we are burning money like there's no tomorrow. We keep building features that nobody wants. We don't have the time in it. We can't afford to keep doing the same old thing over and over again.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know if we were lucky that we had that mindset, but for whatever reason, even though at some level we always believed the next feature we ship was going to save the day and, you know, have a step change, you know, in our profitability and take us to the moon because it's just the best feature since sliced bread, because we were rigorous about testing that, you know, just because we were so desperate to actually make money, I'm trying to think how to put this. We became obsessively committed to actually being right rather than just believing in the next thing to save us. Because, you know, if you look at the traditional hockey stick shaped curve, it's flat for an awful long time. And we had been in a company previously where we were always promised, yeah, it's flat now, but we're on the verge of the hockey stick.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem with the hockey stick plan, when that's your plan, is to like work for a year and then in the 13th month you're going to go to the moon. For the 12 months, you don't know if you're making progress or not because you're following the plan. Everything's flat like it's supposed to be because when the final feature comes into place, you're going to go to the moon. So we just didn't believe that was going to happen. And so we forced ourselves to actually test each feature to see if it was going to be successful. And then we just stopped being able to drink our own Kool-Aid because we were just wrong so often. It became harder and harder and harder for us to convince ourselves that it was a good financial investment to just kind of randomly try the next new thing versus actually trying to say, hey, is there a way that we can increase the probability of having a successful feature?
Yeah, and I think that there's probably two other things too, right? You charge from day one, so basically every experiment you ran was an experiment to make more money.
That's right.
Right?
That's very helpful.
So why would you not run experiments if you're charging from day one? And then the second thing is that, I mean, this gets us to the second topic, which is you guys weren't doing any of this really in public because you had not launched the product, right?
Amen.
Nobody knew who you were, but people at the same time were using the product. So how did you do that?